Well, tonight, Linda Moulton Howe is with us with some incredible stories. Next hour, she'll give us a quick update on what she did in Brazil and the special crop formation science conferences. In addition to that, we'll take conversations with Linda later on tonight as well. Linda's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, of course, award-winning television producer and reporter and author. Linda Moulton Howe is with us. She's been all over the world lately. Linda, bed bugs, huh?
Yes, bed bugs are a problem not only here, but in Brazil, where I have just been, and basically everywhere.
Did you get attacked by bed bugs?
No, I say that only generally because it is becoming a huge global problem. And 2 weeks ago, on the weekend of September 18th, the Nike sports company shut down a 95,000-square-foot Nike Town store in Midtown Manhattan, and they kept it closed for more than a week. And the reason is to exterminate the bed bugs that had literally taken over every nook and cranny of that building.
Oh.
Yeah.
And they'd probably jump in some of the new shoes, too.
Everything. And New York City is now rated number one in North America for bed bugs. But the rest of the United States is also infected. Every state, and experts say it's in all the provinces of Canada as well. In fact, Bob Rosenberg, who is vice president of government affairs for the National Pest Management Association, told the Washington Post, quote, "It's the biggest pest problem that we have encountered in several generations," close quote. In fact, beyond New York, one of the biggest hotspots for bed bugs is Ohio, where Governor Ted Strickland wrote a June 30th letter to the Environmental Protection Agency and said, quote, "The bed bug problem has created a very real physical, emotional, and economically devastating situation for many Ohioans," close quote. And one Dayton, Ohio apartment complex owner spent more than $180,000 trying to clean up his buildings, but the bugs came back. Bed bugs have six legs, are reddish brown to black, and are about the size of apple seeds. Bed bugs can turn walls and ceilings black. And what do they feed on? Humans, mostly. Their favorite food for centuries. Bed bug bites can cause big red welts that badly itch on some people, while other people don't feel very much at all. Back in the 1950s, going back half a century, the insecticide DDT was used everywhere to eradicate bed bugs in the United States. But the result is now super bed bugs that have evolved resistance to DDT and most pesticides. One of the biggest unsolved mysteries about bed bugs is why don't they transmit diseases to their human hosts? So far, that is one of the great things about bed bug bites. So far, they don't know of anything that bed bugs transmit into humans. Recently, I asked an urban pest management specialist why bed bugs are such a big problem again in the United States. She is Deanie Miller, PhD, Associate Professor of Entomology at Virginia Tech, and urban pest management specialist for the state of Virginia. Since 2004, Dr. Miller has traveled to Budapest, Hungary, Australia, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, and is soon heading to Bali, Indonesia, to help others cope with the number one pest everywhere in the worldwide resurgence of bed bugs. Here now is Dr. Miller.
One of the reasons that the bed bug spread is becoming so intense is their resistance to insecticides. They have a cuticle on the outside of their body that's almost impenetrable to a lot of insecticides, so they don't pick up dried residues very well. We've killed all of those that can be killed with insecticide, and then what we have left are those that are not very susceptible.
Some people have said, well, it's because we banned DDT.
Well, the thing about DDT that we have to remember is that bed bugs developed resistance to DDT about 8 years after its use. And so from DDT, we started using malathion, and they developed resistance to that. Now, in the U.S., when resistance started to develop, and this wasn't just for bedbugs, but flies and anything that developed resistance to DDT, our method of dealing with that was to increase the amount of DDT we applied and increase the concentration. And we also applied it very liberally, where you had wallpaper that was impregnated with DDT. You had people spraying their cupboards. You had people buying DDT dust and putting it all over everything. We treated the beds, the bed frame, the mattress, the pillows, everything had DDT on it. And we were just ahead of the bed bugs becoming so resistant that that didn't work anymore. And we might have had those bed bugs this last 50 years if we hadn't just put clouds of DDT all over everything. So that resistance did occur, and that's why we have these very, very tough insects that we're trying to deal with now.
Why do you think that there is such an explosion of a problem for the last decade?
Well, I think one of the reasons for this is that we have a lot more people. And in any biological system, if you see an increase in the prey, and that would be humans in this case, then the predator population really explodes also.
We're talking about a kind of super bed bug.
Uh-huh.
Are humans their only food supply?
They are not, but they're the primary source for a long time. I mean, initially, the ancestral bed bug lived in caves and fed on bats. And when human beings moved into the caves and either kicked the bats out or lived with them, the bugs started feeding on humans as well. And then when humans left the caves and started agricultural societies, they moved the bed bugs with them. And since that time, we have transported them everywhere humans have gone. So they're a natural ectoparasite of humans, but they can feed on bats and birds.
One of the most puzzling details that I keep reading about is that bed bugs do not transmit disease.
Anything that lives in your home with you will only have those pathogens that are there in your home, okay? So the bed bug will not carry any different or more pathogens than, say, your cat or dog if they're living indoors with you. They wouldn't have any means of picking up anything in addition, okay? But they don't transmit disease. And we don't know the reason why exactly, but it is entirely possible that because bed bugs feed mainly on humans and don't have any real wild disease reservoir, they have not evolved to have a disease organism that spends part of its life cycle either reproducing or developing in the bed bug. The reason that most people think is because they have not really had an alternative host, an animal host.
Well, is there something about the bed bug itself, though, that makes it more hyper-resistant to pesticides than a cockroach?
No, there is not. Cockroaches are highly resistant to all of these things, too. But cockroaches now, we have bait formulations that cockroaches really like to eat. So German cockroaches, which are highly resistant to almost the same suite of chemistries that bed bugs are resistant to, we can give bait to, and they will eat it, and we are able to give them new formulations of chemistry that way and take care of them. We have no bait for bed bugs.
Humans are the bait.
Right, exactly.
What about this big controversy now between the EPA and the makers of one of the pesticides that is still supposed to kill bed bugs, but there may be great danger to children?
Well, let me clear this up. It's not between the chemical manufacturers and the EPA. The EPA and the chemical manufacturer came to an agreement years ago that the chemical manufacturers would no longer pursue registration of propoxyr. The issue is coming from the state of Ohio that has a huge number of bed bugs and many bed bug problems. And, of course, bed bug treatment is extremely expensive. And they want something done. It's not like propoxyr suddenly in 2007 became more toxic than it ever was before. But it was actually an agreement with the EPA where the EPA said to the chemical manufacturer, if you want to continue to allow propoxyr to be used indoors in the United States, we want you to re-register. That means redo all your toxicological data so that we can reevaluate the toxicity profile. To get that done here in the United States, it takes about 10 years. Testing on rats, dogs, mutagenic effects, all of that. And it costs about $200 million.
Wow. So do you think propoxyr should be used now?
Yeah, I've got really mixed feelings about it. I've certainly been in situations that would be considered inhumane, mainly with the elderly poor. Like if somebody's really getting eaten alive by bed bugs and their walls are black with bed bug feces and they're 70 years old, mm-hmm. it might be worthwhile to come in there and treat that place one time with propoxyr and get rid of the problem rather than come back 3, 4, 5, 10 times in some cases because the bed bugs are so bad. Do I like the idea of using propoxyr and do I think that's going to save us from bed bugs? No. But I think the concern of the Environmental Protection Agency is that if an emergency use permit, that's what was asked for, not that propoxyr be re-registered, but an emergency use permit for bed bugs specifically for propoxyr. And the EPA is concerned that if they do that, we're going to have people and the pest control industry applying propoxyr everywhere in attempts to get rid of bed bugs.
In an average house, where is the place most likely that bed bugs would be hiding out?
Well, most likely they're going to be around wherever the host sleeps. And I don't even want to say the bed here because we certainly in our poorest locations, we have people sleeping on a lot of things that would not be considered a bed. And that's where the bed bugs want to hang out. They want to be close to the human. And if the infestation starts to get large, though, is when we see them dispersing out to other locations in the room and then maybe even to adjacent rooms or adjacent units in an apartment-type situation. If you were somebody who thought you had bed bugs, it would be critical that you get a pest control company that is familiar with dealing with bed bugs to come in and inspect and treat your situation. I have to say one of the reasons that bed bugs have spread is because there's a lot of people attempting to treat them themselves. And I would say we have had 0% success with that, okay?
And what are the symptoms that people should look for related to bed bug bites?
The reactions are so variable. Just in my lab here, my reaction, big, red, swollen, but doesn't itch. Some of my other students itch like crazy. My technician has no reaction at all. He does a lot of our feeding of the bed bugs on himself. We've actually used him for a lot of our tests because he has no reaction. So it's quite variable.
Do you think the bed bug problem is going to spread to every state in the United States?
It's already there. It's been well documented for a while. And the National Pest Management Association also just did a survey of over 1,000 pest control companies across the world. 95% of them have dealt with bed bugs. They aren't dealing with them on a daily basis.
We have to learn how to live with them. And one of the keys, if I have understood, is that very hot water and hot temperatures in drying, such as sheets, that heat will kill bed bugs?
Yes. Yes, it will. And I'd say the dryer is more important than the washing, really. When I'm saying dryer, I mean more than sheets. You know, you've got to remember, people sleep on a lot of things other than beds. Most people that are really having the bed bug problems typically don't have beds at all. So what we are talking about here is putting anything that can go in the dryer and survive it. And it doesn't have to be at the hottest temperature. Most dryers get pretty darn hot.
Right.
And the thermal death point is about 118 degrees Fahrenheit.
At 118 degrees Fahrenheit, all known bed bugs will die.
Yeah, including the egg stage. The hot dryer, if you can put stuffed animals in there, if you can put things in a bag and put shoes in there, all these types of things, the dryer is really our good friend. And in the United States, we have now a bunch of heat treatments that can be done. I was talking to a pest control company today that's been using a heat chamber for hotel rooms. They build a styrofoam chamber in the center of the room, put all the furniture in it, and they treat around the perimeter of the room with conventional insecticides and then treat all the furniture in this heat chamber that they set up. And that works well. Or you can purchase for about $55,000 a heating system. And it's actually worthwhile for some apartment complexes because you don't have to be a pest control operator. You don't have to go through training to treat with insecticide to use it because it's just heat. And where you load in 3 or 4 of these very large heaters and you use a lot of fans and you cause positive pressure inside of these dorm rooms or apartments and basically cook the bed bugs out.
So is your bottom line, bed bugs that are resistant to pesticides are here to stay and humans have got to learn how to live with them?
Unless something dramatic changes, we are going to be looking at living with bed bugs. You know, we've got certain apartment complexes here in the state of Virginia. There is one in particular, 1,200 units, 90% infested.
Oh, wow.
That apartment management paid $100,000 last year in pest control. What did they get for their money? 90% infested. What did they do about it? Sell the complex. And I just wonder how many I don't know about, and then multiply that by all 50 states, and then let's go into Canada. And that's what I'm wondering is going to be the future. Are you itching yet, George?
What a mess, Linda.
Well, oh, it really is something. And the University of Kentucky's College of Agriculture recently reported that some of these new super bed bugs can survive for up to 16 days after being directly sprayed with currently used pesticides designed to kill insects immediately. That means and shows the strength, the resistance of these new superbugs, because the same pesticides would immediately kill other insects. And another part of this story, Ohio has felt desperate. And they are the ones who went to the Environmental Protection Agency asking for this special emergency approval to use Propoxer. It is the only, as far as I know, it is the only known available insecticide that does and will kill bedbugs.
Mm. It's got a downside, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, and on August 19th, Associated Press reported, quote, "Feds to Ohio, no Propoxer to fight bed bugs." And the AP went on to say that federal officials are standing firm against letting Ohio fight bed bugs in homes with what they call an industrial strength pesticide, which is Propoxer. And an official with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says that it is concerned about children being exposed to Propoxer because EPA research has found that the nervous systems of children can be harmed by that insecticide. So again, we're at a confluence where the environment is changing, sort of. I guess you would say that we tried to eradicate these insects 50 years ago, and what did we do? In ignorance, using DDT, we made DDT-resistant bedbugs. And today, in 2010, they are not only DDT-resistant, they are resistant to just about everything except heat. And I think it is fascinating, as Dr. Miller said, that these new units that come into apartments or schools, and the whole idea is you heat up rooms to 118 degrees Fahrenheit, putting the furniture inside to be heated up, that is in some ways now the best and safest and most effective way to treat bed bugs, but it is expensive.
Man, it's just in these regions, it's interesting. Some of these states like New York and Ohio, Pennsylvania, have more than most, but it's hitting all over the place. Right?
It is, and it began in this last decade in the highest end hotels. And the reason? Because the way that they think this is spreading around is bed bugs are extremely efficient in jumping onto clothes and in suitcases. So it's the people with money who can travel, who go to other countries where bed bugs have always been because there was no DDT, and they bring those bed bugs back. And now it started that the highest end, the most expensive hotels in New York and other places are where they had the bed bug problem first, and they have tried to treat it, but the bed bugs are spreading wildly, and I think that Dr. Miller has given us a warning. We may be in for the foreseeable future with learning how to live with bed bugs.
All right, stay with us. More with Linda Moulton Howe in a moment. I love ancient archaeology. Wait till you hear this story. You know, Linda, I am fascinated with ancient stories. Michael Cremo's work in forbidden archaeology, the work of Zechariah Sitchin and his Sumerian theories in Egypt as well. You've got a great story here. Go ahead.
And it goes back way further than Sumeria, Egypt, Stonehenge, It goes back further than anything you've ever heard of before. I'm talking about 12,000 years ago. And I hope that you and all of our coast listeners will go to earthfiles.com right now. And at the top of the headlines page, I have a hot link to this report, Göbekli Tepe, 12,000 years old and rewriting human history. And the images, I think, are amazing, and they help tell the story. And they include photographs from John Anthony West and Robert Schock, who were in Göbekli Tepe in May, just about 4 months ago.
That's in Turkey, right?
That's in southeastern Turkey. And why did John Anthony West and the geologist Robert Schock, who did his work in geology and his PhD at Yale, now teaching at Boston University, want to go to this site in Turkey? Well, we have to go back to the beginning of the 1980s. It was discovered then that the Egyptian Sphinx had evidence of weather erosion. And at first, it was discussed that perhaps this this was wind or something that had eroded the Sphinx, and that this might have occurred around 5,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. But then French-Egyptian scholar R.A. Schwaller-de-Lubitz asserted that weathering was caused by water at the end of the last ice age, perhaps even as long ago as 10,000 BC, which is 12,000 years ago. The water erosion possibility caught the attention of Egyptologist John Anthony West, who was also the author of the 1993 book, Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt. So in 1989, John West had asked Yale-educated geologist Robert Schock, who was a professor at Boston University then and is still now, to travel to Egypt to examine the Sphinx and look at this erosion issue. And could Schwaller-de-Lubitz be right? If this is water weathering, wow, how far back might it go? Well, the exposed surface rock with deep fissuring and this kind of rounding that water does indicated to Dr. Schock that the Sphinx had eroded from rainfall, specifically rainfall, long before 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. At the time, there was no known civilization that could push the timeline back 12,000 years, as John Anthony West also suspected. And now comes an astounding discovery of huge limestone columns erected in a series of repeating circles in southeastern Turkey that do date to 12,000 years ago. And this started in 1994 when German archaeologist Klaus Schmidt, PhD, from the University of Heidelberg and the German Archaeological Institute, began to slowly and carefully excavate a large hilltop site called Göbekli Tepe, and that is about 6 miles northeast of Urfa, Turkey, which today is a city with a population of about 1 million people. Now, this is older, as I said, than Egypt, Samaria, and Stonehenge, and so far there are 40 standing T-shaped limestone columns that have been uncovered in four circles that are 98 feet in diameter. Ground-penetrating radar surveys indicate there might be at least 250 more of these huge standing stones in 18 still buried circles. Now, on these big standing stones are very fine, very honed reliefs. That's when you have creatures or objects that come up from the limestone as opposed to being carved in. And there are some full-blown three-dimensional sculptures on the limestone columns that are really quite amazing to look at when you go through these photographs at earthfiles.com. And on all of these columns, these various reliefs and a couple of the 3Ds, they are featuring things like wild boars and foxes, lions, birds, snakes, scorpions, vultures, reptiles, humans, and other odd figures and symbols. And it provoked German archaeologist Schmidt to say that he has no idea what these reliefs and three-dimensional carvings mean, and to date, no metal tools have been found since this meticulous digging began in 1994, which is incredible, George, because how do you take limestone and do reliefs that are quite detailed without having some kind of a tool?
Exactly.
Yeah, and today, at the end of 2010, only 5% of the Göbekli Tepe temple complex of these repeating stone circles has been uncovered since Dr. Schmidt started meticulously dating and digging in 1994. Now, adding to the mystery of who built Göbekli Tepe and why is this revelation that they've discovered 10,800 years ago, the entire Göbekli site, after it had been erected, after all these huge stones were there standing, it was buried. Now, how long would that have taken? Did the makers have knowledge of some impending danger? And the effort needed to erect that many large stone circles, over 200, weighing up to 15 tons or more each, 12,000 years ago, and then 1,500 years later, the entire temple site is buried. I mean, that is incomprehensible to me, to John Anthony West, and to everyone who has begun to realize the size, the significance, and the age of Göbekli Tepe. But whether or not we ever learn who built Göbekli Tepe and why, the carbon dating at 12,000 years ago gives new life to the theory of John Anthony West and geologist Dr. Robert Schock that the Egyptian Sphinx is at least that old as well. And 4 months ago, in May 2010, John West and Robert Schock traveled to Göbekli Tepe to see for themselves the extraordinary temple site in southeastern Turkey that John says is the smoking gun after their 20 years of trying to show that the water erosion on the Sphinx means it is much older than originally thought. And several of their incredible fresh photographs are at earthfiles.com with John's permission. And here now is John Anthony West.
Göbekli Tepe is the smoking gun. There's no way around that. And even though we still can't date the Sphinx, the water weathering now stands on its own. They can no longer say, where's the potsherd? Because we don't need a potsherd. We've got a whole gigantic ceremonial site with carved reliefs. We were pretty sure, having watched the way that Schmidt worked and having read what methods he was using to date the stones, that he was not leaving anything out. But nevertheless, until you go there, you don't know for yourself. But after a week, we became absolutely 100% convinced that Schmidt knew exactly what he was talking about, and the fact that his fellow academics were not challenging him was maybe even more convincing than the evidence itself, because this upsets their whole paradigm, and this upsets the apple cart.
Right.
So you bet that even if they had a chink in Schmidt's armor, they would be pushing battering rams through it, trying to explode the theory. So even though it's not in Egypt, it's not that far from Egypt, and recently there was a big article about how trade routes were found between eastern Syria and Egypt. The mere fact that nobody knew before that as early as, I think, Middle Kingdom, that there was regular trade going on between Syria and Egypt. I mean, if you could get to Syria, you could get to Turkey. What they found so far are four closely packed stone circles, rather like Stonehenges. These consist of two central pillars, massive central pillars between 10 and 15 tons each, surrounded within a set of two concentric circles of smaller pillars. And the pillars themselves, 10 to 15 tons, this is, you know, without equipment, this is a pretty big chunk of stone to bring up the hill. The quarry was half a mile away downhill to get them there. And then, even more amazing than that, are the carvings, which are, they look a bit Mayan and a bit almost Easter Islandy and a bit Egyptian, pre-dynastic Egyptian. The best are absolutely spectacular, and they're raised relief, which is the most difficult kind of sculpture to do. That means that it's somebody draws the lion or the crane or the fox or the wild boar on the stone, and then they cut the way, somehow or another, they cut the way the surface of the stone so that the relief seems to be jumping out from the stone rather than being cut into the stone. Now, these things are done in 10 to 15 ton blocks without any metal, as far as anybody knows, without any tools. We don't know. We know that they've found at least 18 other sites. Now, whether or not all of those sites are more stone circles, I don't know. There are other serious mysteries. There's a little black bead, and it's a very hard stone, kind of a basalt-like, or a very hard shale or something. It's a really hard little stone that's maybe an inch square and maybe a quarter of an inch thick. And it has a hole, perfect hole, drilled lengthwise through the quarter-inch thickness. Now, how the hell, without any metal, you drill the bead of a necklace? Perfect hole through a piece of hard stone without any metal whatsoever, as far as we know.
12,000 years ago.
12,000 years ago. So this is a big mystery, but we think, Chuck and myself, that these reliefs, which are mainly animals and insects and snakes and scorpions, and some of them are anthropomorphic human figures as well, and we think these are probably astronomical, astrological, cosmological. They didn't go to this trouble to put 10 and 15 ton blocks of stone in the middle of a stone circle and carve them with animals. It has to be something consequential. The energy that goes into this is mind-boggling.
If I understand correctly what you and Robert Schock talked about together, if it were completely excavated and we could see all 18 of the circles, you are hypothesizing that possibly each circle is monitoring and keeping track of a different piece of astronomy?
Well, maybe. I mean, look, this is a total mystery.
Well, John, Ian Hodder at Stanford University, he's a professor of anthropology there.
Yes.
He says, quote, "Everybody used to think only complex hierarchical civilizations could build such monumental sites, and that they only came about with the invention of agriculture. Göbekli changes everything. It is elaborate, it is complex, and it is pre-agricultural. That alone makes this site one of the most important archaeological finds in a very long time," close quote. And Schmidt goes further. "This time, what came first was the temple and then the city."
That's right, yeah. They had a mindset, or a heart set, you might say, so different from our own that we wouldn't dream of trying to make a Göbekli Tepe. We could fly to the moon, but nobody would sit down and try without any kind of tools that we know of, lug 15-ton blocks up a hill to build a stone circle. What for? I mean, they have some very good reason for doing this. We just don't know what it is, and we may never know.
I'm curious what it felt like to touch the remarkable reliefs that we're seeing in these photographs.
Oh, yeah. Well, limestone. But because it was buried for the last 10,000 years, it's really practically perfect. I mean, there's hardly anything in Egypt that's as perfect as that, as unweathered. You know, the pillars with the reliefs on them, you can run your fingers over them. You had the sense of the tremendous antiquity of it. You know you're in a holy place. They're building according to the principles of sacred geometry, and that resonates. You know, it's the difference between a Beethoven quartet and gangster rap. How do you know? Because it's music. So in music, it resonates. The earth is great line, the architecture is frozen music.
When you have stood now in Göbekli Tepe, what is your mind's comparison to the sophistication of what you're seeing there in Turkey versus what you have seen in Egypt?
Well, that's a good question. This relief work varies a lot from circle to circle, and even within a stone circle, some of the reliefs are quite simple, but some of them are exquisitely detailed, and they have a kind of whiff of the Mayan sort of. There's one that says it's a lion. We're not so sure it's a lion, but it's a feline of some sort, maybe a mountain lion or something like that, that seems to be practically jumping out of the stone. It's not quite like anything. It's reminiscent a little bit of Egypt, It's an extremely high level. I mean, if it were in Egypt, you know, if they found it in Egypt, the academics, they wouldn't consider it a stretch to say, well, this is the forerunner of what popped up in Egypt later on. It's enough like it. You know, it doesn't look Chinese. It's really powerful, and who knows what it'll look like if they ever eventually get it fully excavated and cleaned out and open to the public. I would think that it would have the kind of emotional impact that a Stonehenge has, or that Egypt has.
That's an exciting story, Linda.
Well, I'm curious what, as you look at all of these photos, what is your gut reaction to what you're looking at?
Well, I don't know, other than the fact that I think West is absolutely correct, along with Schrock, that something happened a very, very long time ago, and this civilization out there that is quite obvious must have had or possessed some kind of technology, I think.
Well, it yes. And then you go, da-da-da-da, is it human or other?
Is it human or other? That's absolutely correct. I've always thought it was other. How about you?
Well, you know, when you go to Plato and the Critias and the Timaeus, where he talks about Atlantis, according to Plato, this guy Solon told him about the big, huge, some kind of seismic event, and that this great island continent called Atlantis sunk straight down into the water, and the years that Plato gave were 9,000 years before Plato, which would have put it back around this period of time, 11,000, 12,000, 10,000 years ago. And sometimes I wonder if we were looking and investigating around the world specifically at that age, maybe that is related to a comet coming in, an asteroid coming in, something huge, and maybe the makers of Göbekli Tepe had some kind of ability to know what was happening when danger was upon them, and that that would have provoked the burying of this gigantic temple site. And if they had other technology that might be other than terrestrial, then maybe burying it all would not have been as difficult as it seems to all of us today.
What also is fascinating, when you look at Sumeria in Egypt, this region as well is all pretty close to the Middle East. And it's very possible that they were there a long time ago. If you would talk to Michael Cremo, Linda, and I'm
yeah.
sure you have, he would yeah. say they're millions of years old.
Well, you know, just getting academic certainty, that's what Dr. Schmidt, the German archaeologist, is giving the world now. He's been quietly and slowly working on this site since 1994, and you haven't heard about Göbekli Tepe before this year, have you?
No, not
right.
First time.
So he's slowly been building up the case, and that 12,000 years is sticking. And academics are now going to have to start revising everything. And as you look at the maps, one of the interesting things is how the Black Sea and the Mediterranean Sea are, you have these two big bodies of water on either side of Turkey, and we don't know what the landmass was like 12,000 years ago.
All right. Up next, Linda will give us an update on her situation in Brazil. And then we'll have conversations with Linda, your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.